Now, our first speaker this morning is Jerry Fabris. He began working in the curatorial division at Edison National Historic Site in 1989. Since 1993, as the curator of sound recordings, he has headed a project to preserve, catalog, and make available historic sound recordings at Thomas Edison's West Orange Lab. He is currently completing a master's degree in ethnomusicology at Columbia University. Most of you know him. He's been around here for a while. He was the program chair before me for the last couple of years, so I owe him a debt of thanks for trying to help me figure out what the heck I'm supposed to do up here. So, Jerry.
Thanks, Jim. And thanks, everyone, for getting out of bed early. I have a number of slides, so if the lights could be dimmed up here, that'd be good. There's a focus knob on top. Maybe somebody could fix that. Oh, okay. Okay, good. Okay. Okay. 12 years ago, in 1986, ARSC member Mike Beal put together a very nicely produced LP record album called Edison Speaks, a collection of all the known recordings of Thomas Edison's voice. These recordings and Dr. Beal's excellent liner notes make up the first comprehensive study of this topic, that I'm aware of at least. With my presentation today, I'd like to build on this study by taking a very close look at a recording that I came across about 3 years ago, which I'm convinced is the earliest existing recording of Edison's voice, made in the year 1888, when the inventor was 41 years old. Dr. Beal, in his liner notes on the Edison Speaks LP, made the observation that all of the recordings known at that time of Edison's voice date from the final third of the inventor's 84-year-long life. In reference to the sound of the older Edison's voice, Dr. Beal wrote, quote, "What we are hearing is the ragged remnant of a voice of a late middle-aged elderly man who was almost totally deaf by the time the earliest example was recorded. There's a faint hint in the first two recordings, made when Edison was 59 and 61, that his voice might have been smoother and richer when he was a younger man," unquote. So what is really exciting about the 1888 recording, and why I think it's worthy of special attention, is that it allows us to take an 18-year leap back in time from what was formerly thought to be the earliest recording of Edison speaking into an era when he was still doing some very significant, innovative work on the phonograph. As Jim Farrington mentioned in my introduction, I've been working for about 5 years now on a project to preserve and make available the collection of historic recordings at the West Orange Laboratory. Even though this is a very old collection, most of the recordings have been at the lab since they were made, this current preservation project represents the first time in the history of the museum that every recording on an individual basis is being fully identified and cataloged. In addition to improving storage conditions and cataloging the collection, one of the major tasks of the project is to make archival preservation re-recordings of all the especially rare and or fragile records in the collection. And I'm happy to say that with help from a grant that we received this year from the NARAS Foundation, we're going to be able to install a preservation re-recording studio on site. This will allow us to transfer recordings at the Edison storage facility without having to transport them off-site to do the work at an outside studio. I hope by the fall, we'll be set up to start transferring test pressing discs. And as I mentioned a couple days ago, I'm still in the process of looking into getting a cylinder player. 3 years ago, however, it was not looking likely that we would be able to do the work on site. Our plan at the time was to transfer the most high priority recordings, if only in small numbers at a time, at another location. In 1995, I arranged with Don McCormick at the Rodgers and Hammerstein Archive in New York to have Adrian Cosentini engineer a group of transfers for us. We decided that for the first group of the project, we would reformat the 43 recordings in the collection that were made on the type of wax cylinders that Edison was using in the year 1888, the era of the first perfected phonograph. Edison wax cylinders that date from 1888 have a very distinguishable appearance. The cylinder that you see on the left is from 1888. And as you can see, it's made of a very distinctive light yellowish color material. And it's slightly taller and has a narrower wall thickness than the later standard size. After initially locating these 43 cylinders in the archive, I looked through the museum files and gathered relevant cataloging data about the recordings. And in reading through the files, I realized that one of these cylinders was clearly identified as being of Edison speaking. So even before we actually played these cylinders in August of 95, I was fairly certain that one was going to be Edison's voice. I did not know, however, what type of sound would actually be on the recording. As many of you heard during my presentation on George Gereau last year, some of these cylinders from 1888 sounded very good given their age, but some turned out to be mostly noise. But when it came time to play the cylinder labeled Thomas A. Edison, fortunately, out of the heavy surface scratch emerged a surprisingly clear sounding and very energetic voice. Since then, in an attempt to answer as many questions as possible about the recording, I've been collecting information, many bits and pieces of evidence, which, taken as a whole, provide a reasonably clear picture of what this cylinder is. When I began this investigation of the Edison cylinder 3 years ago, I realized that with an unusual artifact like this, it would be a mistake to rely solely on the sound of the recording as the source for information. As all of you know, there are many useful ways to go about studying a recording. So in carrying out this research, I've pursued four general avenues of investigation. These are, first, the physical object and its associated artifacts. In other words, the cylinder itself, as well as the case in which it was stored and how it was originally labeled. Second, the sound of the recording compared to other recordings of Edison's voice. And in a moment, we'll hear such a comparison. Third, archival documentation from 1888, such as newspaper clippings, letters, and historic recording transcripts. And fourth, museum documentation that exists showing where the recording has been since Edison's death. Before I present my findings, I'd like to briefly explain why there are not more recordings of Edison's voice from this earlier period. It's well documented that while experimenting with the wax cylinder phonograph or demonstrating its capabilities to others, Edison often made recordings of his own voice. Because the operator of a phonograph stands near the machine, his or her own voice is a logical and convenient part of a recording experiment or demonstration. However, as a rule, Edison would destroy recordings of his voice soon after they were made so that they could not be duplicated and replayed at a later time. In fact, even more generally, Edison regularly avoided all types of public speaking. Due to his severe hearing loss, he lacked adequate control of his speech and apparently did not like the sound of his voice. A typical situation is portrayed in news reports of one of the earliest public exhibitions of his wax cylinder phonograph, an event that took place at a meeting of the Electrical Club in New York City on May 12, 1888. Edison himself was present at the meeting. However, he declined to address the group's members and guests as a whole. At the opening of the program, Edison's assistant, Ezra T. Gilliland, gave the introductory speech. After Gilliland's formal presentation, several phonographs were displayed in different locations throughout the various rooms of the Electrical Club house. Edison himself is reported to have operated one of the machines and to have made recordings of his voice for smaller groups of onlookers. Yet no recordings of Edison from this evening were saved. But even though wax cylinder era recordings of Edison's voice are extremely rare today, it's clear that on a few occasions, records of his voice were saved. For example, an article about Edison that appeared in an 1898 issue of the Ladies' Home Journal, the author of the article described the circumstances of two such occasions when recordings of Edison's voice were saved. Quote, "To one close friend, Edison reluctantly gave a cylinder recording of a few of his words, and to a young man who particularly interested him, he gave another on which is recorded his favorite story," unquote. Thanks. This is how the object of this study is stored today. Fortunately, it was fairly well identified when it was made. As you can see, it's enclosed in an old-looking wood and glass exhibit case with two other cylinder records, a phonograph reproducer, and a phonograph recorder. A handwritten label in front of the case reads, "Reproducer and Recorder, three records made on the first perfected phonograph in 1888/9. Inside each of the cylinders is an embrittled slip of paperboard with identification information. The three labels read as follow. On the far left, Thomas A. Edison, talking from New York to Buffalo, Buffalo to Chicago, et cetera, made in 1888. And then the second one, soprano, sung by Effie Stewart, taken in January 1889 by Theo E. Wangeman. And last is March, played by Isler Orchestra, March 1889, taken by W.H. Miller. Very significantly, the handwriting on the first two record labels appears to be that of Theo Wangeman, one of Edison's most notable early recording experimenters. And also, this handwriting of the Walter Miller label we've identified as Walter Miller's handwriting and his signature. That's a close-up of the two that are the same in terms of handwriting. And you can see, it's not only the letters, but there's this swish down at the bottom of it. Now this, in the center, is taken from Theo Wangeman's recording log. And I don't know if that can be focused any better, but you can tell it's very clearly the same signature there. You also note that the dates on these two labels are not specific. The label for the Edison cylinder is dated only by the year, 1888, with no specific month or day given. Similarly, the date written on the Effie Stewart cylinder label does not give the day, only the month and year, January 1889. However, in the F.E. Stewart cylinder recording itself, it is dated to the specific day. An announcer with a German accent, probably Wangerman, starts the recording by saying, "The Patterson Waltz, sung by Miss Effie Stewart of New York City, Orange, New Jersey, February 25th, 1889. Oddly, the month on the written label and the month stated in the recording are not the same. This leads me to believe that Wangerman labeled the two cylinders at some point weeks or months after they were made on the basis of a recollection. Theo Wangerman died accidentally on June 2, 1906, so the labels must have been written sometime before this date. But regardless, we can say with reasonable certainty that the Edison cylinder itself was identified sometime early in its history by Theo Wangerman, a person who was an expert in the field of recording and who worked directly with Thomas Edison. Before I go any further into this description, I'd like to actually play the recording. I'll play the 1888 cylinder of Edison's voice first. Then following that will be the next earliest existing recording of Edison's voice, a cylinder known as the Liver Story, made 18 years later in 1906. And transcripts of both are on the handout.
Now, Mr. Blaine, as you've been here around the world, I took you around the world on the photograph. I'm not glad you were in here. I'll take you on the steamer, the night steamer to Liverpool, and from Liverpool to London, from London on the London and Brighton Railroad to Brighton. And from Brighton, we'll go on those little 2 cent steamers across the English Channel to Calais. And from Calais, we'll go on the Chemin du Fer de Nord. I can't give you the exact Parisian pronunciation of this railroad, but I guess you'll understand. We'll get into Paris and make for the Grand Hotel. Then in the morning we'll go to our bankers and get a little money on our letters of credit. Then we'll go and stay around Paris for about 2 weeks, go to Berlin. After we've stayed about 2-3 days in Berlin and got the blues, we'll go to St. Petersburg. And St. Petersburg, we'll go to Moscow, and from Moscow, back by the same route to Berlin. And from Berlin, we'll go to Vienna, and from Vienna to Budapest, to see the Hungarians. And then most people would go to Monte Carlo. But we'll not go to Monte Carlo, we'll go to Munich, or Munchen. I believe they call it Munchen, but that's not a very nice name to me. I like to call it Munich. Well, then from Munich we'll go to Milan. Milan we'll go to Rome. Rome we'll go across the Mediterranean Sea. I don't know, but what I'm a little out of my geography. We'll go to Alexandria. Alexandria through the Suez Canal to the Red Sea, into the Bay of Bengal, and then to Bombay. Bombay we'll probably get the car and stay in the hospital 2-3 months and have lots of fun. And then we'll go to Calcutta, Calcutta to Singapore on the Malay Archipelago, and then to Hong Kong, Hong Kong to Tokyo, Tokyo on a Pacific Mail Company to San Francisco, San Francisco to Auckland, Auckland to Laramie to Cheyenne to Omaha, Omaha to Chicago, Chicago to Pittsburgh, Harrisburg, Philadelphia, New York. Now, Mr. Blaine, why don't you say a few words on another cylinder so my young man can bring it over to the laboratory. I want to put it through a process to get several hundred duplicate cylinders so other people can hear what you say. Goodbye, Edison.
Hey, Walter Miller, did you ever hear this story of this California story? About 25 years ago, a man from Boston who was a furniture dealer had a very bad case of liver complaint. So he went to California and rigged out a team and started down the San Joaquin Valley with the idea of testing all the mineral springs that were in that valley so that it might relieve him of the terrible pains he had from his liver complaints. Well, he traveled down the valley for the whole summer and he had no relief. But towards the end of the valley, he came to a spring and it immediately relieved him of his pain. Well, he was a very wealthy man, so he started a sanitarium and sent the circus all over the world, and by and by there were people who came from all parts of the world and stayed at the sanitarium, and their liver complaint was cured and they were relieved of their pain. Well, about 20 years afterwards, the man died. And at the coroner's inquest, they had to take his liver out and kill it with a club.
In my opinion, the voice on the 1888 cylinder sounds quite similar to the 1906 recording. One of the most distinctive features apparent in both is the cadence of the speaker's voice. The voice does not sound exactly the same on these recordings. However, those differences that do exist can be reasonably attributed to the following. First, Edison was 41 years old in 1888 and 59 years old in 1906. The natural human aging process over these 18 years would account for some difference in the sound of his voice. Also, Edison's hearing deteriorated gradually throughout his life. It is reasonable to assume that as his ability to hear his own voice lessened, the way he pronounced and projected his words also changed. Second, because the recording process was significantly improved throughout the 1890s and 1900s, recordings made in 1888 have a different sound quality than those made in 1906. On the later recording, we hear a wider range of frequencies, less noise, and less distortion. And third, the exact recording speed for both of these cylinders is unknown. Therefore, the proper playback speed and voice pitch can only be approximated. The recordings as we have just heard them were both set by ear, so one or both may be either too fast or too slow. But why would Edison make a recording like the Around the World cylinder, and what did he mean by the words he said? The earliest example of Edison reciting a list of cities in the context of a phonograph demonstration, interestingly, dates back to the era of the tinfoil phonograph. If you look at your handouts on the second page, this page here, there's a news article written in February of 1878. The author of this article visited Edison at his Menlo Park laboratory and was given a demonstration of the phonograph by the inventor himself. At the very end of the article, down at the bottom right corner, Edison is reported to have made a recording on tinfoil very similar to the 1888 recording. However, the travel route is headed in the opposite direction and incidentally goes through Syracuse. In my opinion, the voice on the 1888 cylinder sounds quite similar to the 1906 recording. One of the most distinctive features apparent in both is the cadence of the speaker's voice. The voice does not sound exactly the same on these recordings. However, those differences that do exist can be reasonably attributed to the following. First, Edison was 41 years old in 1888 and 59 years old in 1906. The natural human aging process over these 18 years would account for some difference in the sound of his voice. Also, Edison's hearing deteriorated gradually throughout his life.
It is reasonable to assume that as his ability to hear his own voice lessened, the way he pronounced and projected his words also changed. Second, because the recording process was significantly improved throughout the 1890s and 1900s, recordings made in 1888 have a different sound quality than those made in 1906. On a later recording, we hear a wider range of frequencies, less noise, and less distortion. And third, the exact recording speed for both of these cylinders is unknown. Therefore, the proper playback speed and voice pitch can only be approximated. The recordings as we have just heard them were both set by ear, so one or both may be either too fast or too slow. But why would Edison make a recording like the Around the World cylinder, and what did he mean by the words he said? The earliest example of Edison reciting a list of cities in the context of a phonograph demonstration, interestingly, dates back to the era of the tinfoil phonograph. If you look at your handouts on the second page, this page here, there's a news article written in February of 1878. The author of this article visited Edison at his Menlo Park laboratory and was given a demonstration of the phonograph by the inventor himself. At the very end of the article, down at the bottom right corner, Edison is reported to have made a recording on tinfoil very similar to the 1888 recording. However, the travel route is headed in the opposite direction, and incidentally goes through Syracuse, and through some different cities only in the United States. This type of travel itinerary description was something Edison used regularly for the purpose of demonstrating the phonograph. Perhaps there is a reason why Edison chose a more elaborate travel route on the 1888 cylinder. In his demonstrations, the wax cylinder phonograph had to pass a more difficult test than did the tinfoil phonograph. A tinfoil recording in 1878, when the phonograph was completely new, simply had to reproduce a recording well enough to show that the phonograph worked at all. But a wax cylinder in 1888, because it was to be used for office dictation, had to reproduce a recording in which every word could be clearly understood. A trip completely around the world through foreign countries provided Edison with a long list of uncommon, not easily understood words, which were useful as a means of demonstrating the capabilities of the phonograph as an aid in transcribing dictated letters. One such demonstration was done by Edison at the May 12th meeting of the Electrical Club in New York City. A news report of the event described the following scene, quote, "The most remarkable application of the invention is its use in connection with the typewriter. A young lady sat at a typewriter, took down Mr. Edison's dictation, and wrote it out sometime after. Mr. Edison spoke so quickly that without the phonograph, it would be impossible for the lady to take down his words. But the inventor rattled away into the phonograph, the impressions were recorded, and the tube adjusted to the lady's ear gave her all the time she wanted to reproduce the sentences. It is easily seen that with the introduction of the new phonograph, expert stenographers will not be much in demand," unquote. A similar scenario was reported in mid-December of 1888 at Edison's West Orange laboratory. A journalist who visited Edison at the lab described, quote, "To illustrate how perfectly this phonograph gives back what is said to it, I left the room while Edison read out to the phonograph a long list of geographical names of different points connected by a certain electric table. And upon coming back into the room, I listened and repeated what I heard," unquote. This type of phonograph rearticulation test can be tied directly to the Around the World speech by two very similar but not duplicate typewritten transcripts that exist in the Edison archive document file for the year 1888. I've included one of these on the next page of the handout. If you look at the top of this transcript, titled Mr. Edison's Trip Around the World, you'll see that it has a handwritten note above the typewritten words that reads, "This is the young lady's second effort at dictation from the phonograph, and she heard the instrument for the first time in her life not more than 20 minutes before this was written." Clearly, this transcript shows that the travel itinerary on the 1888 cylinder recording was something Edison used on more than one occasion for the purpose of demonstrating the ability of the phonograph to record and reproduce a message that otherwise would be difficult for a stenographer to follow. Unfortunately, I've not been able to pinpoint the exact circumstances in which the existing Around the World recording was made. I do not have a definite time and place. But given the information that does exist, we can make some reasonable assumptions. The trip that Edison described began and ended in New York City. Therefore, I think it is likely that the recording was made in or near New York. Also, at the end of the speech on the cylinder, Edison states, "Now, Mr. Blaine, won't you say a few words on another cylinder so my young man can bring it over to the laboratory?" This indicates to me that Edison and Mr. Blaine were probably together, Edison demonstrating the phonograph for Blaine, and that they were not at the West Orange Laboratory, although probably not far, when the cylinder was recorded. Because West Orange is only about 15 miles from New York, these two assumptions are consistent with one another. Regarding the date, I found no reason to doubt Wangerman's label that says made in 1888. However, I've not been able to arrive at a more specific date than the year alone. The next page of your handout shows that on October 26, 1888, in the New York Tribune, it was reported that an Edison phonograph and several cylinders, including one referred to as Mr. Edison's account of his trip around the world, were exhibited at the 3rd Battalion Fair in Orange, New Jersey. It's possible that this is the exact same record of the study. However, as I have shown, more than one cylinder with this type of speech was made. The earliest and latest datable references to Edison having given similar demonstrations with a wax cylinder phonograph that I've come across are on May 12, 1888 at the Electrical Club meeting and December 14, 1888, the date of the newspaper article mentioned earlier. In addition to archival evidence, the physical characteristics of the cylinder support the conclusion that it was recorded during the same general time period. As I described before, cylinders made around the time of the perfected phonograph have a very distinctive look. The recordings on all the other datable cylinder records in the collection at the Edison site that share these same physical characteristics are all from 1888 or early 1889. None of this type are dated later than March of 1889. And by the summer of 89, the color and shape had evolved into a more familiar looking regular brown wax cylinder. The one on the right here was made in July of 89. A remaining question that with regards to this recording is, who was Mr. Blaine? This question remains unanswered. However, there is some circumstantial evidence that suggests this may have been James G. Blaine, a politician from the state of Maine who was prominent in the National Republican Party during the 1870s, 1880s, and early 1890s. During this time, it was not uncommon for Edison and James G. Blaine to be in contact with one another. Several documents in the Edison archive reveal that the two were acquainted and may have met on occasion. And as we know, Edison was demonstrating the perfected phonograph to many very prominent people at this time. The most substantive clue as to the identity of Mr. Blaine is given at the start of the cylinder. Edison begins by saying, Mr. Blaine, as you've been nearly around the world, I'll take you around the world on a phonograph. Given this statement, the fact that the trip starts and ends in New York City, and the time frame outlined above, one can surmise the following. Mr. Blaine probably was, first, someone who had traveled extensively, and second, in or near New York City, sometime roughly between May and December of the year 1888. James G. Blaine fits this description quite well. From mid-1887 until August of 1888, James G. Blaine traveled throughout Europe, having left the United States to deliberately remove himself from consideration as the Republican nominee for president in the election of 1888. Then for most of the month of October in the United States, Blaine toured the states of Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, and New York on campaign for Benjamin Harrison, the Republican nominee. On several occasions and for extended periods of time during August through November, Blaine was in and around New York City. And from late October until the election on November 6, he occupied a room in New York City and made brief campaign trips to neighboring areas, including a number of trips to New Jersey and at least one to Orange, New Jersey. However, although I've searched very thoroughly through several New York City and Newark newspapers from 1888, I've not found reports that mention Blaine having met with Thomas Edison. Possibly they met privately, but this question remains unanswered. I do not know at this point who the real Mr. Blaine was. As the last part of this investigation, I'd like to take a look at the existing evidence of the cylinder's whereabouts after it was made. It is unknown at what point the cylinder was placed in its wood and glass display case, although the case and the case label both appear to be quite old. Their apparent age suggests that the case might have been on display during Edison's lifetime. However, I've not been able to locate the case in any photographs taken before Edison's death in 1931. Not unlike many artifacts in the Edison site collection, the earliest specific reference that I've found for this cylinder as a museum object is on its catalog card in the files of the Thomas A. Edison Incorporated Historical Division. The Historical Division was established in the late 1920s to identify all objects of historical value within the West Orange Laboratory and Factory Complex. Throughout the 1930s, 40s, and early 50s, before the National Park Service acquired the laboratory, the Historical Division cataloged several thousand artifacts. In January of 1942, a catalog number was assigned to the exhibit case containing the 1888 cylinder, which at the time was kept in the TAE Incorporated Edifone Division. Around the same time, the case was moved from the Edifone Division to display on the library mantle in the building five of the Edison Lab. This photo here shows February 11th in 1947, Edison's 100th birthday celebration. And you can see on the far left is Charles Edison and his mother, Mina, in front of him. They're looking at Thomas Edison's desk, which had just been opened for the first time since he died. But if you look up on top of the mantle there, below the painting, you can see that there are two cases. Both of those are in the collection. The one on the left is the case that contains the Edison cylinder. That's a little closer. And there's the case there. Walter Miller is listed on the catalog card as the source for the artifact. Like Wangeman's label for the cylinder, this is another highly significant piece of provenience information. Walter Miller started work on the phonograph with Edison as a young man in the late 1880s, went on to head the Edison Recording Division until it closed in 1929, then worked in the Edifone Division during the last years of his life. Almost all of the authentic early famous voice recordings on Edison cylinders that exist today are those that were saved by Walter Miller. So the origin of the 1888 recording of Edison's voice is very different than, for example, the dubious recording of Walt Whitman that was proven to be a fake 6 years ago by Alan Konigsberg. As Mr. Konigsberg demonstrated in the Antique Phonograph Monthly, the Walt Whitman recording does not exist in its original cylinder format, only on tape, and it came from an unreliable source, the collection of a Mr. Roscoe Haley, who, as Konigsberg explained, was the source of other highly questionable famous voice recordings. The Edison recording, by contrast, exists in its original format, has never left the Edison complex, and was identified and preserved by two very reliable sources, Theo Wangerman and Walter Miller. A question that has been posed to me several times about the 1888 recording of Edison is, how could it be that the Edison site had this recording in its possession, but no one knew about it until 1995? It's only recently, in the last 5 years, that the Edison site has had the staff necessary to undertake a project to individually identify every one of the historic sound recordings on site. As is true for many chronically understaffed museums and archives, artifacts can sit in storage undisturbed for many years. The 1888 recording was identified and cataloged by the Edison Company in 1942, then again by the National Park Service in 1964. It was also re-recorded once before in 1953 by the Edifone Division. But for some reason, even though it was available on tape after 1953, it never made its way onto any of the famous voice LPs reissues that were done in the 1950s and 60s. So the recording was never really lost. It has been sitting in storage in its same designated location since 1953. And as far as I can tell from the museum files, its authenticity was never questioned. It simply was forgotten. I value this recording because it enables us to hear Edison while he was still very much on the forefront of technological innovation. So this is no liver story, in other words. In the 1888 recording, I hear an energetic, creative, influential person in the midst of literally sending his ideas around the world. Although less than 3 minutes in duration, the cylinder opens a precious window of insight into the personal character of the inventor of recorded sound. Thanks.
What are the three cylinders in the other case on the mantel?
The other case, I don't remember exactly. One is a Garot recording. They're all from 1888. I don't remember exact.
So now none of these six cylinders were part of that box of cylinders that was found behind the cot in 1978?
No, no.
Okay, so that's why I did not have that on the list that Leah supplied.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. That explains that story. In 1988, we had a meeting, an arts convention up in Canada, and I did a short presentation. It was going to be the 100th anniversary of the oldest known recording, which of course is Baron Stanley of Preston. And like 3 days before I left to go up to Canada, I gave Leah a call, Leah Burt at the Edison site a call, just double checking to see whether any older, or whether that cylinder had been found. And she said, well, Mike, we just found a box of cylinders, and several of them are dated earlier than the Baron Stanley of Preston. So she quickly sent me up to Canada, three Polaroids of the box, and she had somebody make out a list of that and dictated that list over the telephone. So that was the first announcement of those. And I had wondered when this cylinder came up as to why we hadn't noticed that back in 1988. And that explains it.
Yep.
Yet these different white wax cylinders you're carrying up, you said you had 43, Mike's added some others.
No, 43 includes those.
Yeah, 43 includes those. All right, is there a list that's available or that you intend to publish?
Of those white wax cylinders, yes. They've all been transferred, and they're available upon request, the recordings and transcript, lists. So, yep.
I noticed a distinct Scot-Irish accent there with a little touch of Canadian accent mm-hmm. in that first cylinder, and there was very little of that in any evident 18 years later.
Hmm. To me, I need to have a linguist look at these. To me, I hear a very similar type of, distinctive cadence in the second, but I'm not an authority on accents.
It's a distinctly different inflection.
Hmm.
What struck me is it sounds like a man in control. The first man he's got his testosterone flowing. Second man is dried out.
If you look at his patent, his patents in 1888, he was a man in control. In 1905, he had sort of dried out. But
I'm David Hall. I have a question about Theo Langerman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Have you made a comparison between Langerman's voice on these cylinders and the voice on the Brahms cylinder?
No.
It has been raised that the one with the voice on the Brahms cylinder is actually Herr Dr. Brahms.
Oh.
Whether it is Langerman.
Okay.
It might be interesting for you to compare Langerman's voice with the voice on the Brahms cylinder.
Okay. Yeah, I actually have never heard the Brahms cylinder.
I've reproduced a number of times,
mm-hmm.
CD, LP, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That voice actually says, the voice on the Brahms cylinder actually says, I am Dr. Brahms.
No, it does not. And also they say that in saying Gruß Gott to Edison, the word that people are claiming is Edison is Fehlinger. How anybody can get Edison out of what is clearly Fehlinger, which is the name of the owner of the house where the cylinder was recorded, is beyond me. There is also no reason why Brahms would be speaking English. So it is not saying that I am, it is by him, Dr. Brahms. It's by, not I am.
Seth?
It's kind of like Jerry Springer.
Yes!
Jerry Springer would leap at his throat.
I think he's right.
Because we worked on that waltz, and my head, I'm going through the voices there. They're rather high and brilliant, just like the Brahms cylinder. And it may be the same person.
You're speaking about the Effie Stewart announcement?
Yeah, where he says the
okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he had a very high brilliant sound. Now the Brahms one too. Whoever's saying that, I think the inflection is the same.
Yeah, that would be interesting to compare those.
So. Has there been any voice print analysis made on any of the recordings that you talked about this morning?
I've been talking to a professor at Barnard College. His name's Professor Remez, and he does voice analysis and is interested in doing a number of comparisons of several Edison cylinders. It's interesting also to compare the Liver Story 1906 to some like 1920 recordings, because those don't match that well either. But, Ray? Mm-hmm.
Second thing is, in order to get a little bit of balance of the this page of the handout,
yeah,
at Pacific Edison Phonograph Company,
right,
that was one of the first of the companies organized under the Edison phonograph company. It predates North America.
Mm-hmm.
And when, of course, went into North America, it became the Pacific Phonograph Company, not the Pacific Edison Phonograph Company.
Right.
So this document is probably, unless they were using up some paper, before mid-1880.
Oh, before mid-1880. Yeah, I looked through the archive, and the earliest reference I could find to that company was from June of 88. And one theory that they were doing a lot of experimenting with mailing cylinders. And one thing that one of our archivists, Doug Tarr, suggested, possibly they had mailed a recording from West Orange to San Francisco and were doing a transcription test, you know, transcribe it in San Francisco and then sent the letter back. That's just the theory, but... Yeah, three of them. I played one last year.
I've never seen that box displayed, the reproducer and the recorder at the site in the early 60s.
In the early 60s. Do you know where?
I would try to see that again later on, like in the early 70s, we used to have the meetings over there.
Do you know in what room or?
I don't remember what room. It was a display showing the LP machine. Remember, it was an Edison LP with a long play reproducer, like suspended. Mm-hmm. That box was in there. That box was in there. Early 60s.
They had the machines in the front room of that of the same room where you have the phonographs now. That's what I remember when I was at the site the first time in 1959. So that was
there.
So it was where the LP was, and it would have been in that building, back in that building.
Kurt?
I take it this box of cylinders that Mike was referring to earlier had been stored away out of sight, out of light, all those years, and yet it appears that these cylinders were on display for many decades. Does it appear that the light has affected them in any way?
They all three of those sounded really good, but the color, you can tell from looking at the object itself, one side is discolored, it's darker. So yes. I looked at the Edison recording under a microscope, and was trying to see whether or not it had the square cut shape, but it really was kind of a jagged shape, so it was hard to determine, you know, exactly how the cutter was intended to be shaped. But it was sort of, you know, like this. It wasn't a well defined.
Do you think it matches the stylus on the cutter in the box?
I looked, and it was hard to tell.
Was it a string wound cylinder?
No.
flit, which was that a mosquito spray. And I remember when I was a kid, it had the same smell. And every distinct.
Effie Stewart announcement?
Yeah, where he said the okay. Waltz, you remember?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. On it, and he had a very high grating sound. Now, the Brahms one, too. Whoever's saying that, I think the inflection's the same.
Yeah, that would be interesting to compare those.
So. Has there been any voice print analysis made on any?
I've been talking to a professor at Barnard College. His name's Professor Remez, and he does voice analysis and is interested in doing a number of comparisons of several Edison cylinders. I mean, it's interesting also to compare the Liver Story, 1906, to some like 1920 recordings, because those, you know, don't match that well either. But, Ray?
Gold recycling presentation cylinder that the realist presented that in 1906. The second thing is, in order to get a little bit prolonged of the this page of your handout,
yeah,
you had a Pacific Edison Phonograph Company.
Right.
That was one of the first of the companies organized under the Edison Phonograph Company. It predates North America.
Mm-hmm.
And when, of course, was went into North America, it became the Pacific Phonograph Company, not the Pacific Edison Phonograph Company.
Right.
So this document is probably, unless they were using up some paper, before mid-1880.
Oh, before mid-1880. Yeah, the earliest, I looked through the archive, and the earliest reference I could find to that company was from June of 88. And one theory that they were doing a lot of experimenting with mailing cylinders. And one thing that one of our archivists, Doug Tarr, suggested, possibly they had mailed recording from West Orange to San Francisco and were doing a transcription test, you know, transcribed it in San Francisco and then sent the letter back. That's just the theory, but. Yeah, three of them. I played one last year.
I remember seeing that box display to the reproducer and the recorder at the site in the early 60s.
In the early 60s. Do you know where?
It disappeared again. I remember trying to see that again later on, like in the early 70s. We used to have the meetings over there.
Do you know in what room or?
To tell you the truth, I don't remember what room. It was a display showing the LP machine. Remember, it was an LP, Edison LP, with a long play reproducer, like suspended. Mm-hmm. That box was in there. That box was in there. Early 60s.
They had the machines in the front room of that of the same room where you have the phonographs now. That's what I remember when I was at the site the first time in 1959. So that was
there.
So it was where the LP was, and it would have been in that building, back in that building.
Kurt?
I take it this box of cylinders that Mike was referring to earlier had been stored away out of sight, out of light, all those years, and yet it appears that these cylinders were on display for many decades. Does it appear that the light has affected them in any way?
They all three of those sounded really good, but the color you can tell from looking at the object itself, one side is discolored, it's darker. So yes. I looked at the Edison recording under a microscope, and was trying to see whether or not it had the square cut shape, but it really was kind of a jagged shape. So it was hard to determine, you know, exactly how the cutter was intended to be shaped. But it was sort of, you know, like this. It wasn't a well defined.
Have you seen if it matches the stylus on the cutter in the box?
I looked, and it was hard to tell.
Was it a string wound cylinder?
No. No. Yep.
Also want to state here too, that it gave off a certain smell. You remember that? It smelled like you flit, which was a mosquito spray. And I remember when I was a kid, it had the same smell. I never just did sniff them.
Maybe they sprayed it. They had bugs in Jersey.
Mosquitoes.
Quick, Henry, the flits.
That's not a tradition. That's what it smelled like. That big smell.
Jersey's a swamp.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Greg. Great. Our next speaker is someone who had I'm almost positive, has never addressed ARSC. I think this is her first ARSC meeting. Her name is Rebecca Dodson. She's assistant professor of horn and music history at Northeast Louisiana University in Monroe, Louisiana. She received her DMA in horn from the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 1997, where she cataloged the Curtis Blake collection as part of her doctoral work. This is just one little stop on her busy itinerary this weekend. She's got a recital coming up this weekend and an audition and God knows what else. So this is, we're very glad that she was able to make it here for this conference. So, Rebecca Dodson.